Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We are going to talk about threats to our country that we need protection against, both foreign and domestic, in the course of this program, as we generally do. I'm always pleased to be able to welcome to the show a man who has devoted much of his professional life to doing just that. In a variety of incarnations, notably as an investigative reporter of great renown, as a successful author of both fiction and nonfiction works, and not least as the president of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran. His name is Kenneth Timmerman. He has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, among other distinctions, for his work with the Foundation for Democracy in Iran. And we're going to talk with him about that portfolio. But before we do, I wanted to both welcome him properly and talk about a topic closer to home. Ken, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
Pleasure is mine. Let me ask you, Ken, as the author of a work of fiction, but that turned out to be pretty predictive, about the 2020 election entitled Election Heist, what we should make of the evidence that has been accumulating inexorably since that election was completed, that in fact there was massive fraud and it affected the outcome of the election.
Well, look, that's absolutely right, Frank. My book, The Election Heist, came out in August of 2020. So well before the election, I wrote it as a fiction, but not a fantasy. It was the result of 10 years studying election machines, election machinery, getting kind of under the hood of Democrat plots to steal elections. I wanted the Trump administration to pay attention to it. Unfortunately, they did not. I think if they had paid more attention to what was going on, we might not have wound up where we were. Look, everybody who watched the election results on election night knows what happened. They stopped counting the votes at 10:20 because Trump was winning with huge majorities. There was no way they could possibly get past those majority, and they had to figure out what to do next. They decided to stuff the ballot boxes. We all saw it, and we were told not to believe our lying eyes. Remember Gabe Sterling in Georgia? He said, no, those are not ballots that are being brought up from under the table and then being fed into the machines again and again and again. Those are ballots that have already been counted and are being put back under the tables. Don't believe the video. Don't believe your lying eyes. That's what they wanted to do after 2020. And I'm afraid this new Ministry of Truth that the Biden administration has set up is going to try to trick us again.
I am too. I want to talk more about that in a moment. But before we do, among the evidence that has been aggregated, Ken, in basically all of the swing states, are not one but two documentary films, one entitled Rigged, brought to us by David Bossie of Citizens United, the other 2,000 Mules, produced by Dinesh D'Souza, documenting in very compelling ways what actually happened. You mentioned stuffing of ballot boxes in particular. I don't know if you've seen either of these films. I've seen Rigged, but not yet had a chance to see 2,000 Mules, but I'm told authoritatively that they're equally convincing, that those who have persistently told us there's nothing to see here, folks. Indeed, some of these news outlets have gone, to extraordinary lengths to suggest that there's absolutely no evidence of fraud. There's evidence of fraud every time, I think, but talk us through what we're learning from these films and to the extent that it does, what we should make of this, big lie that we're told by people who say that any of us who are concerned about this are the perpetrators.
Right.
of Big Lies.
So if any of you have any doubts whatsoever, go watch those two films. They're very important. They talk about, Rigg talks about Zuckerbucks, how Mark Zuckerberg basically put in an election fraud mechanism using $400 million from his foundation. And then you see how that actually took place on the ground with 2,000 mules. There they have 27 terabytes of information that they acquired showing the geolocation of cell phones. So they were tracking the cell phones of these mules, taking ballots, mail-in ballots to the ballot drop boxes. And these people were so arrogant, they would stand there with their cell phones and take selfies so they could get paid for them. And we know that because they also purchased the security camera footage. Now, here's the real kicker, Frank. For those people who say there was no election fraud whatsoever, there was a guy in particular in Georgia, who's making like 16, 15, 14 drops a day, and he would go back to one address, apparently, to pick up the ballots. And guess where it was? Stacey Abrams' office. So they're going from Stacey Abrams' office, picking up ballots, and then taking them around to different drop boxes, photographing himself so he could get paid, and going back and getting more. Now, if that's not evidence of election fraud, really, I don't know what is.
Well, it sounds like evidence of criminal activity on the part of a gal who's running for governor, as last time I checked, in the state of Georgia at the moment. Ken, you alluded to this disinformation governance board, so-called, recently established in the Department of Homeland Security. And one of the things that's so infuriating about this, I mean, I think it's a mortal threat to our First Amendment myself, but to add insult to injury, as they say, the woman who is in charge of it, by the name of Nina Jankowicz, was herself the perpetrator of some of the disinformation that arguably impacted directly the outcome of the last election for the presidency in 2020, namely the character of Hunter Biden's laptop and whether it in fact suggested that not only Hunter but his dad were implicated in, treasonous activities, I would say, with the Chinese Communist Party, the Russians, Ukrainians and others. What are we to make of that as an example of actual election manipulation, if not outright fraud? And shouldn't that be a disqualifier for anybody who's supposedly running this operation to assure election integrity, no less?
Well, look, Frank, George Orwell got this right. This is a ministry of truth. Government should never, ever be in charge of determining what is true or false in the public space. It's not their business. They are an interested party. It's obvious on the face of it, but if you're a Democrat, you can't allow anyone to naysay your little fantasy or your fiction. So they're trying to gaslight us. Look, it's very simple. We experienced in 2020 a putsch. We experienced a coup d'etat. They stole our election, they stole our country, and I think Americans that I'm talking to want us to take our country back this November.
Well, I think we certainly are entitled to do that in the event that this can be further established as fact. I think you're right. The vast majority of Americans, I think, are now convinced of it, and it's simply infuriating that we've not seen federal judges stepping up to allow that evidence to be presented properly in court, or for that matter, the Congress getting to the bottom of it. This is really, I think, an abdication of their duties in the judicial and legislative branches, respectively. And then there's the Justice Department, which is obviously not going to get into this properly either. Ken, we have to take a brief break. When we come back, I want to switch gears with you and talk about this other area of great expertise you have, namely what's going on in Iran, and specifically what's up with this Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. We'll talk about that and much more with Ken Timmerman on the other side of this short break. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The leak of a draft Supreme Court opinion signaling the majority's intention to overturn Roe v. Wade is an ominous indication of what may be in store for the country over the next 6 months. Expect actions aimed at preventing such a decision from being finalized and/or influencing this fall's elections. They might include institutional assaults like ending the Senate filibuster to enact pro-abortion legislation and perhaps pack the Supreme Court. Alternatively, there may be physical threats against its justices, or perhaps even a renewed color revolution laying waste to American cities like the so-called Summer of Love 2 years ago. The latter require an end to the Biden administration's politicization and weaponization of U.S. national and homeland security agencies against its partisan foes. Real threats to freedom must be countered, not deflections like white supremacists, insurrectionists, and disinformation. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and I'm thrilled to say Ken Timmerman is with us still. We're going to pivot, though, from election heists in the United States to another kind of fraud, the fraud that is being perpetrated by the Biden administration in its pursuit of a deal that will not be worth literally the paper it's written on with Iran concerning trying to deny the Iranian regime its nuclear ambitions. Ain't going to happen. But in the course of pursuing that deal, Ken, as you know, the administration has been making concession after concession after concession, indeed, absolutely humiliating, well, not just itself, but our country, as it tries to extract something in the way of a commitment, again, of no particular value from the Iranians. One element of which is this idea that apparently the Iranians have now seized upon that in order to give them a deal, the administration must remove from the designated terrorist organization list of the United States the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran, essentially the regime's army and its Praetorian Guard, if you will, for preserving its hold on power. What are we to make of this idea? Specifically, is there any basis on, is there any basis on which you could say that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is not a terrorist organization?
Frank, look, the IRGC gets their agenda, they get their marching orders right out of the so-called Constitution of the Islamic Republic from 1980, which stipulates that they are not a national army, they are not meant to defend the borders, they are there to defend the regime and to expand the revolution around the world. So that's why we see the IRGC in Iraq, helping militias on the ground in Iraq, why they're in Lebanon training Hezbollah, why they are in Syria propping up the Syrian regime, why they are in Yemen, and get this, why are they right here in the United States? The FBI had an extraordinary case that was made public in early April where they caught two guys, one Iranian-American, another Pakistani-American, who were, one of them was going back and forth to Iran many, many times. They caught them with an arsenal of weapons. They were impersonating DHS officers. They had the special ID cards that you only get, the laminated chip authenticated ID cards. They could hack into government websites. And they had compromised, get this, the presidential detail of the Secret Service. Now, we don't know for sure that they were Quds Force, Revolutionary Guards Corps, but boy, they sure had the profile. And here's the real kicker on that one. They were released from custody by the same federal judge, Judge Harvey, who has oversight over the January 6 defendants. And Judge Harvey said, well, these two guys who could be Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps officers or fit the profile the FBI thinks are tremendously dangerous, they do not pose a threat to the community, but grandma and grandpa do. I mean, unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, Ken. And to add considerable insult, to the injury that is being perpetrated here. The Iranians evidently have already extracted a concession from the United States government to enrich them further with tens of billions of dollars. I'm not quite sure how many, but any would be more than you can justify. And they're sending that into a regime that I think there's no doubt will use those funds both to complete the bomb, point one, and point two, presumably to pay for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps' terrorist activities around the world, no?
Yeah, absolutely. The IRGC controls about 80% of the Iranian economy. So they do all the black market oil deals. The money that is in those banks in Hong Kong, Singapore, Japan, South Korea, and the rest, that's IRGC money. So that's why they want to get them off the terrorism list so they can get access to that money, again, to support their agenda around the world of expanding the Islamic revolution in Iran. By the way, I don't call these people the Islamic Republic of Iran. I call them the Islamic State of Iran because they truly are the first Islamic state.
They are indeed. Ken, among the subjects or objects, let me say, of these terrorist plots of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, we'll be talking shortly with Harold Rode about some others, but I wanted to talk to you about some here at home. Who are believed to be, at the moment, the targets of assassination attempts inside our own country by the IRGC? And is there reason to believe that in addition to the plot that you've just described, they may well be able to succeed at accomplishing terrorist activity here if they are allowed to do so, particularly with greater resources from us?
The State Department has recently announced that they are spending something like $2 million a month to give protection to former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo because of Iranian threats, credible threats that they're trying to assassinate him. They've also said that John Bolton has been targeted by the Iranians. Bolton, because of his support for the pro-freedom movement inside Iran. Pompeo, because he was involved in the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. In my view, the single best national security decision of the entire Trump administration, a wonderful thing to have done, to take out the top terrorist along with 17 other really bad guys. Now, the other target is Donald J. Trump. And how do we know this? Because the supreme leader of Iran, Khamenei, himself posted a video in January. It was a simulation, a kind of cartoon-type simulation, very realistic, though, showing Mar-a-Lago, showing how they were tracking Mar-a-Lago, how they got this armed robot underneath the gate at Trump's golf course in West Palm Beach, and then they targeted him as he was on the about to drive. He was on the tee about to drive, and then it went to blank. So they said, this is not only something that we're actively pursuing, but we can do this. The FBI knows some of these people. They know that they got over 100 Quds Force operatives in this country, and the Biden administration couldn't care less. They released these two suspects in Washington, again, in favor of keeping Horned Man in prison from January 6th.
Yeah, indefinitely, it seems. Let me ask you about one other piece of this. And again, you've devoted so much of your life. You've been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, as I mentioned, for your work trying to help free the people of Iran from this horrible and oppressive regime. Ken, what will the practical effect be on the aspirations for freedom of the Iranian people if this deal is consummated?
I talk to people inside Iran all the time, Frank, and you'd be surprised at how inventive they can get at communicating with the outside world. They're very good at it. The regime tries to track them down, but they don't always succeed. And every time they hear something about the Biden administration negotiations with Iran, they're tearing their hair. They can't believe it. They see it not just as a sellout. They say, look, Ken, we look up to your country as that beacon of freedom. And instead, this administration is supporting the tyrants. They're supporting the mullahs. They're supporting these people who are enslaving 13-year-old girls and selling them off in marriage to old goats. How can you possibly do it? And my only answer to them is that, look, the Biden people are not America. They are partisan Democrats who actually do not act in America's interests and are acting contrary to our interests. They are not the United States of America.
I think that's exceedingly well said, and I'm glad you're conveying that to your friends in Iran. I hope that they have not given up on us, nor do I hope that they'll be permanently enslaved by this regime. Ken Timmerman, thanks for joining us today and for your insights on all of these issues. We hope to have a chance to visit with you again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Harold Rote about that IRGC business and other Middle East problems right away.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we're joined by Dr. Harold Rote, one of our country's foremost experts on places like Iran and Turkey and the Middle East more generally. He was really the duty expert on these subjects in the Defense Department for decades. I had the privilege of working with him way back in the Reagan administration there, and he went on to bigger and better things, really serving our secretaries of defense in the net assessment business, among other things, as they grappled with this important and often very turbulent part of the world. And we're always pleased to be able to pick his brains about what's going on there. Harold Rote, welcome back to Securing America. Good to have you with us. Harold, we were talking a moment ago with Ken Timmerman about the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran and the efforts of the Biden administration to remove them in the pursuit of their Iran deal from the designated terrorist organization list of the United States. You've just covered a story about how they're still very much in the terrorism business, notably against Israeli targets, but also others, including our own. Tell us what's been going on there and what the Israelis have done to ferret it out.
Well, given the morass in Washington, the Israelis are on their own dealing with Iran. And all I can say is that the Israelis got wind of an attack that the IRGC was going to send one of its members, one of its people, that is the Iranian army, the IRGC, first to kill an Israeli diplomat in Istanbul to kill an American general in Germany and a journalist in France. Now, the Israelis got wind of it, and they sent a team to Iran to where this guy lived. I'm not sure, but I don't think it's in Tehran. And they filmed the interrogation where he spilled the beans on everything. And then the Israelis let him go and released the, shall we say, the parts of the interrogation, the interview, that they thought would interest us all. And well, the Iranian government will handle him. That's their business. And so there's, and that's the IRGC. They're still involved in the terrorist business against us, right, here,
including against an American general in Germany. And Harold, I got to say, this is a testament to the Israelis' daring do that they would leave a guy who had seen and interacted with them in place, intact, and have confidence that they would be able to exfiltrate that team, you know, essentially unscathed. It's amazing. And it brings me to the larger question, Harold, of this Iran deal. Any sign that this is now over the side, as some in Israel have been suggesting, or as far as you can tell, is the administration still determined to do it, even if it means saying that the IRGC is no longer a terrorist organization?
Well, let's say that especially the State Department there and is very good at finding a smokescreen, to finding words to do whatever. And behind the scenes, they're going to do what they want. But it'll appear that it's not that way. And all I can say is that I do not trust, unfortunately, our government in Washington. I don't really understand why they really even want to deal with Iran. We have great allies in the Gulf that we've been kicking in the shins or more.
Harold, speaking of the Saudis, I want to just ask you about a development that's taking place this week involving, a pilgrimage, if you will, by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They have been adversaries, to say the least, for a long time, particularly over this issue of the murder by the Saudis of Adnan Khashoggi, a so-called journalist, in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul a couple of years ago. What's the backstory to what's going on there and its implications, perhaps for the region and perhaps for us?
Look, Khashoggi was a senior operative, whatever, of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is an organization which hates America. It hates the Saudi government. The Saudis funded it originally, but in the Middle East, you go up, you go down. Today, I'm your best friend. Tomorrow, I'm ready to stick a knife in your back. Erdogan's desperate for money. It needs, his economy is failing. He's trying to do whatever he possibly can to stay in power. That's why he tries a rapprochement with the Israelis and the Saudis. The fact that Erdogan, as you said, and you're right, is making a pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia. He's basically saying, well, I'll put the Muslim Brotherhood agenda in, because he's also a very important figure in the Muslim Brotherhood. He and Khashoggi were on the same team. So,
indeed, I think it's fair to say that the Turks have sort of become, once the Saudis cut them off, the principal state sponsor of the Brotherhood. They certainly have had all kinds of help they've been providing to the Brotherhood's operations here in the United States, including in their huge mosque complex, the Dayanet, I think they call it, that is essentially an apparatus for running ops against our country, is it not?
Look, the bottom line is they know how to use our culture against us. They say nice words. They have ties and jackets. They smile. And in the Middle East, people know how to wait. It's not time. Have patience. Patience is extremely important. The reason that Erdogan went to Saudi Arabia and in the Middle East, who goes to whom matters. I come to visit you, Frank. You're the important guy. I'm the supplicant. Erdogan is the supplicant here. He's going to say he needs help.
Harold, talk to me quickly about one other facet of what the Turks are up to. You mentioned a rapprochement with the Israelis, perhaps compelled by his financial circumstance. And yet, Erdogan has been one of the principal champions of the idea that the Temple Mount, a very holy site for both Christians and Jews, of course, must be really in Islamic hands exclusively. Inciting the Palestinians, aiding them, enabling them is part and parcel of what he's been up to for a long time. Is there any shift in his posture on the Temple Mount, especially at a time when there's been these violent outbreaks there?
Oh, I have no doubt that he and his, and you know, he's a big supporter of the Brotherhood. Hamas is really a part of the Brotherhood, and you've got Hamas flags everywhere. Whether he has been specifically involved in these issues, I don't think it really matters. Why? Because they have been working for years with the people. They have their own places in Jerusalem where they teach their hatred, and they have taught people, and these people are all, you know, Erdogan can stop for the moment, but he already made, he's making it happen. He made it happen. He prepared the groundwork. Our problem is in America, since we don't have any concept of history, we have, that's history, something that happened yesterday. Erdogan hasn't turned over a new leaf. He's desperate. He will do whatever is necessary. But his philosophy for his entire life has been the same. We hate the West. We hate the America's the head of the West. So we hate America the most. But I'll make nice to it.
And Harold, when you look at that sort of track record, incitement is such an important piece of this. And I think we in the West, particularly here in the United States, don't fully appreciate it. Though, you know, we did enact legislation that at least was designed to stop paying the Palestinian Authority for engaging in it and otherwise fomenting terrorism. But have we been turning a blind eye to what the Turks have been doing, as perhaps has the Israeli government to some extent as well?
You're right. We have been turning a blind eye. Where does it say? I think somewhere in the Bible, there's none so blind as he who will not see. And I can only tell you that from what I'm reading in I want to call it behind the scenes, it's not secret. It's just in secret languages like Arabic, Turkish, and Persian that, you know, we our senior officials haven't a clue about the culture. And they know they're playing with us beautiful, and we're falling into their hands. And whether it's naively or intentionally, I can't tell you that. I don't know. But it's certainly anti-American in the long run.
Yes. Well, Harold, this is one of the reasons we value both your scholarship as well as your practical experience so much, is you do have an intimate understanding of the nature of these cultures, as well as the nuances of the languages. You speak them all, and you have been, as a result of all of that, so invaluable to successive, you know, senior officials in our government and certainly to this program. And we appreciate the chance to visit with you. We'll be watching closely what is coming out of these various negotiations with Iran on the one hand, between the Turks and the Saudis on the other, and not least what's going on with the Israelis, as it seems to me this is a very volatile moment in the Middle East as elsewhere around the world. And it's vital that we understand, you know, who the players are, what their agendas are, and what in particular we can do to try to shape events to the better. Harold, we'll leave it at that. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The leak of a draft Supreme Court opinion signaling the majority's intention to overturn Roe v. Wade is an ominous indication of what may be in store for the country over the next 6 months. Expect actions aimed at preventing such a decision from being finalized and/or influencing this fall's elections. They might include institutional assaults like ending the Senate filibuster to enact pro-abortion legislation and perhaps pack the Supreme Court. Alternatively, there may be physical threats against its justices, or perhaps even a renewed color revolution laying waste to American cities like the so-called Summer of Love 2 years ago. The latter require an end to the Biden administration's politicization and weaponization of U.S. national and homeland security agencies against its partisan foes. Real threats to freedom must be countered, not deflections like white supremacists, insurrectionists, and disinformation. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. It's a delight to be able to say welcome to our next guest as well. He is Bill Walton. He is the star of the Bill Walton television podcast, a program that I admire greatly and have had a chance to be on occasion. And we're always delighted to do a home and home with him. He brings to this topic of our country and protecting it a wealth of experience on Wall Street, notably as the president and CEO of Allied Capital. He has also been active in conservative movement policy making as the past president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member. He's a good friend as well and always delighted to have him with us. Welcome back, Bill.
Thanks, Frank, as always.
A lot to talk about, my friend. Let's start with Shanghai, Bill. It's a major city of China, of course. It is the largest port in the world, I understand. And it has been in complete lockdown, basically, for the better part of 2 months now. And the consequences of that for us, as well as for the people most immediately involved, are quite significant. Walk us through what is going on in Shanghai at the moment and what we should take away from it.
Well, Shanghai right now is kind of a Rorschach block as to trying to figure out what the Chinese, in particular President Xi, is all about. I mean, they've locked Shanghai down with their zero COVID strategy, and it means 25 million people. As you point out, the largest port in the world. It's four times larger than the port of Los Angeles, and really the hub for the international economy. And he's not just locked down Shanghai. They're of the top 100 cities by population in China. I think about 75 of them are experiencing material lockdowns. And there's lots of worries now in Beijing that he's going to bring it into Beijing. And I say Rorschach because this is one hard to figure out. Xi got all kinds of international accolades because they claimed to stop COVID by locking down Wuhan 2 years ago. And a lot of us are deeply suspicious about whether that really worked or whether it was just his press. And now in this effort to keep COVID-19 from spreading, which we know is impossible, he's locked everything down and he's wrecked the economy. The economy has gone from 10-15% growth a couple of years ago to 6%, 7% last year. Estimates now this year, 3-4%, it may shrink for the first time since Deng took over from Mao and started bringing the Chinese economy into the modern world. What this means is that China's economic clout is really, as they diminish what's going on in Shanghai, it's hurting America. If you look at some maps or look at some graphics of the number of container ships backed up in the Shanghai harbor, it's astonishing. And so global trade has shut down or has been dramatically reduced. And then with the other side of the continent, Eurasia, we've got the Russia sanctions in place, which is hurting Well, it's obviously hurting Russia, but it's also hurting the European economy and also the American economy. And so as you think about Xi's thoughts, does he, is this lockdown really about the virus, or is the lockdown about something else?
Yeah. And there is speculation, Bill, that one of the things that's going on is that there is a restive party faction in Shanghai, I believe led by Jiang Zemin, the previous president or general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, and that, you know, punishing that potential bloc of adversaries in the run-up to this fall's sort of coronation that Xi is seeking for his third term might be a consideration in what he's doing to the people of Shanghai. It seems like a monstrous overkill if what you're really trying to do is punish a certain small bloc of party members.
They've got a Politburo meeting in the fall, and he wants a third term. He really wants it for life, but he's got to get reelected to the third term. And he's locked into this zero COVID strategy. He's also locked into his relationship with Vladimir Putin. And so he's got things that he's not in control of. And if you talk to people in China, the sophisticated private equity investment managers, the whole lot of them, you can't find a single one of them that believe that Xi knows what he's doing with the economy. The best quote is one of them says, "Unfortunately, I think his knowledge and his rationality is limited."
Well, and that's putting it very mildly, needless to say, and discreetly for purposes of being possibly sent off to the gulag. You want to be very careful what words you use about the guy who's running the place. Yeah, but the point is, Bill, that whether it's supply chains or whether it's what they're doing to their capital markets or what they're doing to their people, most especially, what we're witnessing is sort of the worst of totalitarian, tyrannical misrule. And its implications are not confined narrowly to the people of China. As you say, this major seaport is the hub of international commerce in many respects. And just a very quick word, we're going to take a break in about a minute, but how is that having an impact on, you know, shortages in this country of raw materials, products, food, and other things?
Well, if you think the supermarket shelves are growing bare now, just wait till next year. You know, on the Russia side of things, the fertilizer world, which they produce through the natural gas, and also they ship it off to Germany, which produces fertilizers, which help grow the crops. Those prices are off the charts now, and some farmers are even refusing to buy it. And we'll just have to see what kind of yields we get on the China side of it. As I mentioned, there's 75 other economies besides Shanghai, many of them major manufacturing entities, and they're all getting shut down. And the question you really got to ask is, Xi doesn't really care about people except as an abstraction. And he, you know, we've seen the Chinese kill tens of millions of people. And it's clear he doesn't really care about economic growth. He cares about power. And here's something ominous. They're now thinking after shutting down tech firms and...
Bill Walton, we have to ask you to hold that thought. We got to take a hard break here. We'll be right back with more with Bill Walton of The Bill Walton Show. On the other side of this short break, it's a thought that I don't want to truncate. We're going to come right back to all of it right after this. We're back, and we're joined once again, I'm pleased to say, by Bill Walton. He's a regular here at Securing America, and we tap his brains with gusto, particularly on matters involving finance and economics. And Bill, you were just making a point about how international businesses in Shanghai or working with those in Shanghai are being impacted. Finish that thought, if you would.
Well, we have Shanghai, of course, which is the distribution point for all the goods that come out of China and distributed into China. But it's also many of the other major cities, and they're all being shut down with the zero COVID policy.
Yeah, by some estimates, 400 million people being impacted. It's unbelievable. Yeah. And possibly Beijing as well. Well, Bill, one of the things that's so striking about this, and we had a fascinating webinar yesterday that our Committee on the Present Danger China, of course, of which you are a member, sponsored with our colleague Reggie Littlejohn's Women's Rights Without Frontiers. We entitled it The Digital Gulag. And basically what that did was sort of lay out how, under the cover of this COVID-19 pandemic, which came out of, as you said earlier, Wuhan, China, we've seen a succession of steps taken, including this zero COVID policy and the lockdowns and the mask mandates and the vaccines, even if they haven't been properly tested, being forcefully imposed upon people. And China has not only created that China model at home, but it has aggressively sought to have it exported elsewhere, including here in the United States. Talk a little bit about what a stark departure that has been from past practice and how it's really changing not just public health approaches in this country and our response to this virus, most especially, of course, but actually, you know, our country, our polity, our society.
Well, it seems pretty clear that the lockdowns did not work. Steve Moore and Phil Kirpin and Casey, I can't remember his last name, from University of Chicago, just put out a study analyzing how the 50 states fared, and we had a workshop or a test case here where you get all 50 states, different policies with regard to mask mandates, lockdowns, business closures, etc. And the jury's in. After 2 years, the states that did not lock down fared much better on matters of health, their economy, and economic or in the educational well-being. And the states that locked down the most, you know, we can think of them, Illinois and New York among them, New Jersey, their economy hasn't recovered. Their health measures were not any better. In fact, some cases worse. And so the idea now that Xi is still promoting lockdowns, there's something else here, Frank. You and I both know that. I mean, they're using these pandemics, these emergency measures, basically to get control of people. And one of the ways they're doing it is trotting out these ideas of vaccine mandates. Now, that seems to have faded temporarily here in the United States, but I think it's still in the playbook.
And oh, absolutely. And worse, Bill, as we talked about in the webinar yesterday, the mechanisms by which it can be imposed and enforced, notably these vaccine passports, is going ahead as though nothing else had changed.
The technologies are very different. This is not your grandfather's passport that he used to go to France and, you know, after World War II. These are digital. And which means that they not only have your vaccine records, but they've got most of you, they can theoretically have most of your other medical records. Financial records are not far behind, voting records, whatever. I mean, there's a way to get an entire dossier on everybody who has one of these. Now,
right. And this isn't an abstract or hypothetical proposition. Talk about China.
It's already happening. Social credit in China, it is happening. Now, one can say the Chinese don't have a long history of being freedom fighters. It's a much different culture. Nevertheless, we've also seen here in the United States where people willingly put on their obedience masks to signal their virtue with regard to the virus. It can happen here.
Well, arguably it has happened here to some extent, and maybe there's been some relaxation of it, but it's still, you know, sort of in place. And as our webinar pointed out, some 30 U.S. states, including a number run by Republicans, have actually adopted this vaccine passport called perhaps digital health cards or medical cards or something else. But nonetheless, and Bill, this is really the critical point about this sort of digital gulag idea, is if you wind up having migrated onto that card, not just your, as you say, health records and financial records, but also just about everything else about you, who you've interacted with, what you have said in your social media posts, where you're employed, how much you earn, maybe even you get your currency, you know, instituted there as well in a sort of programmable form that can be used again to manipulate or control you. This is chilling stuff, and it is coming here, is it not?
Well, we need to raise the alarm bells because it's already here. It's not been deployed as aggressively as we fear it could be deployed. But, you know, we're seeing things like the Minister of Truth or the Disinformation Bureau or whatever we're going to call it.
And governance board. I mean, that's the operative word as far as I'm concerned.
And, you know, so we need to make this an issue in the elections. We need to have people understand that these are not just people saying and doing stupid things and imposing regulations that hurt the economy and our freedoms, but they also have bigger things in mind, which is controlling what we think and who we talk to. And social credit, if you don't know about it, you ought to learn about it, because it means you get bonus points for doing what the government wants you to do. And you get demerits for doing what they don't. And if you get enough demerits, you can't travel. You can't leave your house. You can't shop. I mean, all those sorts of things.
You may lose your job. Your children can't be educated, and on and on. Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is such a really powerful call for action, not just greater awareness, but action. Absolutely. And be checking with your elected representatives or would-be ones in the course of this election campaign. Bill, thanks for joining us. Thanks to the rest of you for doing the same. Well, we hope you'll do so again tomorrow. Until then, I hope you'll go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.